22, Monsanto Technology, LLC versus EI DuPont and Nemours.
May it please the court, James Hilmer on behalf of Monsanto. Inherency is an exacting legal standard. It requires proof that the prior art's disclosure necessarily or inevitably lead to the claimed inherent effect. Now, there was simply
Let me take you straight to the issue that concerns me in this case, and that's the use of the Kenney declarations and their admissibility and their applicability in this case, and whether they, in fact, expand the disclosure of the specification. Can you address that? I mean, it seems that the Kenney declarations, it's unpublished data. And if it's unpublished data, that did not exist at the time of the invention, so the POSITA doesn't have access to this, then the use of the Kenney declaration simply adds limitations. They constitute missing limitations.
That's exactly our point, Your Honor, and it may be helpful if I just show you why that is. Because this is Kinney, in his second declaration, admits that expressly, and he says that is what he's doing.
He's arguing that the Kinney declarations are prior art. The question is whether they show that the method was inherent in other prior art. And if you look at the claims here, which talk about obtaining a soybean plant, which we can call a progeny, it's the first generation is within the scope of the claim, right?
And so the first generation progeny is within the scope of the claim? Yes.
And when you say that the Kinney only showed one progeny, that's not correct, right? At the first generation, there are over 40. Mm-hmm. Isn't that correct?
Well, it depends on what claim we're talking about, Your Honor. For some of the claims, for example, some of the dependent claims, the claims were rejected on the basis of soybean.
Let's take just claim one first, okay?
Yes.
You say that there's only one progeny. That's not correct. That the Kinney Declaration shows multiple progeny, over 40, right?
The Kinney Declaration shows multiple progeny of a particular generation. So if we look at the declaration,
it's more than 40.
I'm sorry, are you saying more than 40 within the scope of the claim?
Yeah, because this claim includes the first generation, right?
The claim includes the first generation.
And Kinney's declaration shows that in the first generation there are more than 40, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't.
It does not?
No, and this is what I want to point Your Honor to.
I don't understand how you can say that.
Well, let me explain it to you. Dr. Kinney is not actually presenting data for the first generation of the soybean plants in his declaration. So this is Appendix 360. This is his declaration, the second declaration, where he is purporting to identify information that was left out of the patent's disclosure. And he actually says the data set, and this is in the footnote on Appendix 360, this data set represents the fatty acid profile for seeds from the F2-3 generation of plants from which the plants summarized in Table 12 were self-pollinated to produce F3-4 progeny. Now, if you go back to the patent, the F2-3 is not the first generation, as I understand it. My understanding is the F1-2 would be the first generation. This is describing another generation. And what he's describing is a generation that's wholly absent from the disclosure of the Booth patent at all. This generation is not present in the Booth patent. And
But wait a second. What we're trying to figure out here is whether crossing the two parent lines produces progeny that are within the claims, right?
Right.
And you say repeatedly in your brief that this crossing in Booth only produced one progeny. And I'm trying to understand what the basis for that contention is.
So the board identified for some of the dependent claims, and I think where Your Honor is looking at my brief is when I'm addressing several of the dependent claims. There was one progeny plant that the board identified in the Kinney Second Declaration that allegedly met the claim requirements.
So you admit that there's more than one progeny within the first claim?
Yes, and I'm not contesting that, and if my brief was unclear about that, I'm sorry. I believe that the board had identified 15 progeny plants within one cross. So we're crossing, we're doing a cross, and then we're collecting progeny. And then in Dr. Kinney's...
And the claims don't require any specific number of progeny as
granted,
a result of the cross, correct?
Granted.
Right.
The claims don't require any particular progeny, but the progeny has to result from the performance of the claim steps.
Correct.
Right.
But what I'm not understanding is how can it be that the claims themselves don't require that you obtain the same progeny every time, and that they're satisfied if you obtain some progeny, and you say, oh, well, the prior art method doesn't come within the claims because they didn't produce the same progeny every time. I'm having trouble following that.
Sure. It's implicit in the definition of inherency, I think, Your Honor. Inherency requires inevitably
happening. If your claim doesn't produce it every time, how can you say that prior art that does the same thing is not anticipatory?
But it's not the same thing, Your Honor. It's not the same method as in the prior art.
Well, that's a different question. But your argument... And we need to address that. But your argument is that it's not anticipatory because it doesn't produce qualifying progeny every time. That can't be a distinction because your own claim doesn't require producing the same progeny every time. And indeed, obviously, contemplates that will only happen some of the time.
Right, Your Honor, but I think we're confusing two issues. I think the first issue is what does the prior art disclose? The prior art has to inevitably result in the production of soybeans that are within the claim scope.
That's my problem. I don't understand the inevitably, since your own claim doesn't require inevitability.
It doesn't require inevitability, but that's a different issue. That's what the claim requires, Your Honor. It's not. We're looking at the prior art, and the standard for inherency is inevitability. So the prior art must show inevitability in order to inevitably, inherently disclose anything.
If the prior art does the same thing that your own method does, which is not inevitably producing this progeny, then why isn't it anticipatory?
It's not because it's not shown to result from the steps of the claimed method, Your Honor. The board was mixing and matching two different data sets. There is no express disclosure in Booth of the claimed method. No denying that.
No, well, the board went. Wait a minute. No denying that. The board found that it did disclose the method of crossing these two parent lines. You have an argument about whether 4% is about 3%, but put that to one side. Booth discloses crossing the two parent lines, right?
Booth discloses crossing a D2T containing line and a fan allele containing line, which may have 4 or 5, depending on which fan allele line you use. And it also discloses a D3A gene-containing line. The D2T D3A gene-containing line is not established to result in any progeny ever within our claim scope.
The board found that it disclosed crossing the fan allele line with the D2T, whatever it is, right?
The board stated in its opinion that it believed the D2T fan allele line, as shown by Dr. Kinney's secret data, resulted in at least some progeny
claims. They found that the patent showed crossing the two parent lines, right? Forget about what the result of that was. That is a different question that's addressed in the Kinney declarations. But that what the board found is that the prior art patent discloses crossing the two parent lines, the fan allele line and the 2DT.
The board found an express disclosure of the crossing step, but not the obtaining step.
Okay,
right?
So you admit that the prior art shows the crossing step, putting aside the 3% and 4%, right?
Well, what we're mixing and matching things, right, Your Honor? But I don't deny D2T falls within the scope of the one of the lines in the cross. I do deny the fan allele line does, because it the claim talks about 3%, not 4%.
Okay, but put aside the 3 and 4%, and I understand that argument, and we'll turn to that. But the prior art patent does show crossing the two parent lines, including the fan allele line, right? The D2T, whatever it is, and the fan allele. It shows the crossing of those two lines, right?
It shows an alternative crossing pattern of either a fan allele line or a D3A line.
And the board found that showed the crossing of the fan allele line, right?
The board found that the fan allele line was about 4% and met expressly the limitation.
About 4%. I'm just trying to get to put that to one side for the moment.
I'm trying to be as responsive as I can.
The board found that the prior art patent shows the crossing of the D2T and the fan allele lines, right?
That is my understanding.
Okay. And do you contend that's not supported by substantial evidence?
I contend that there's no evidence that that produces the claimed progeny.
That's a different question. I'm talking about crossing the two lines.
I am not disputing that D2T meets the definition of the second line in Monsanto's claimed cross. I am disputing the fan allele meets the definition
because
of the first.
Because of the 3 and 4%.
Because of the 3 and 4% issue. But if you ignore the 4-3 issue, then the board has found an express disclosure of both of the parents in the cross. What the board has not found anywhere in Booth is the second step, the obtaining step. And you only get to the obtaining step by going through Dr. Kinney's declarations and resorting to secret data. And he admits in his declaration that's what he's doing. I'm now in my rebuttal time, but yeah,
you call it secret data. It doesn't look like secret data to me. It looks like data that wasn't discussed. There's a difference.
It wasn't
kept as a secret in any fashion.
Well, I think it was until it was disclosed in this declaration. I think it's not disputed that it was in DuPont's internal files and it wasn't available to the public, Your Honor.
And then it was part of his work, and he chose to rely on other parts of his work. But that doesn't make it secret. It makes it undisclosed to the public, which is different. They weren't maintaining a trade secret, for example.
I don't know if they were or not, Your Honor, but I've called it secret because it was not available to the public. I didn't discern the distinction you're drawing, but that is
well,
the reason I called
I
it
read
secret.
It as, in some sense, pejorative.
I did not intend to be pejorative about it. It was more alliterative than anything,
well,
Your Honor.
Then let's put it that way.
And if I may reserve the...
Why don't you address, before you sit down, the 3 and 4% issue?
Three is not four. It's basically there's nothing.
Is it about four or close to?
Three is
around four.
The nature. Can I answer it this way, Your Honor? The nature of the evidence that was presented in the expert declarations was based on statistical deviations of measuring lines. Monsanto's expert said it was about 1 or 2%. This is the Harrison declaration. DuPont's expert relied on a standard deviation of wild-type soybeans, which have around 7 or 8%. And so he's using an inflated number, and he's calculating the standard deviation as being 0.8. And then the only way that they got up to 4, DuPont, is they rounded up the number. Dr. Kinney literally took his standard deviation and just rounded it up to 4. And so that was his opinion. I'm going to take an inflated deviation and round it up to 4. But if you actually use the calculated standard deviation that Dr. Kinney and Monsanto's expert Dr. Harrison provided, you don't get to 4.
But even so, I mean, the board construed the term about 3% less to also encompass 4% and cited intrinsic evidence. I mean, what...
The problem is the intrinsic evidence that the board cited on that issue, Your Honor, was not based on any statistical metric that any of the party's experts had identified.
But it was based on, forget about the experts. We're talking about intrinsic evidence. They found it in your own patent, right?
If you look to that patent, there is a description of that line as having around 3.35 or thereabouts. I can get you the exact number. Mean. We're talking about. The mean is.
But what they found was that the prior art reference that was mentioned in the patent includes a range that goes up to 4.1%, right?
If you look to the highest outlying data point, you get up to 4.1%, Your Honor. But that was not
so
what
your
anyone...
So yes.
My answer is that is not a reasonable disclosure of that Wilcox paper, and it wasn't cited to redefine about 3% to include something that goes out to the highest data point. We're talking about statistically reasonable metrics. And if you go to the most deviating data point, Your Honor, that's not a reasonable metric. I'll reserve the 7 seconds I have.
No, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I think it's important first to understand the limited way in which extrinsic evidence was used in this case.
But what happens if we discard the Kinney declarations? Do you still win?
Your Honor, the Kinney declarations were unrebutted. In fact, the second declaration, they put in no responsive testimony.
But the answer is no, you don't win.
Well, we do depend on the Kinney declaration for one thing, Your Honor, and that's the inherent properties, fatty acid properties, of the expressly disclosed F2:3 generation. So what I'd like to point out is this is a claim with two steps. The first step is the crossing step.
Wait. I mean, the prior art patent discloses the crossing. We have the argument about the 3 or 4%.
Yes.
But it does not disclose progeny that come within the claim.
That's where I do disagree.
And without the Kinney declarations, you know, there isn't any evidence that the prior art produced progeny within the claim. So if you don't have the Kinney declarations, you're gone, right?
We do need it for the
yes?
property. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and before you get to the content or the merits of the Kinney declarations, let's talk about the admissibility. They're uncorroborated, unpublished data at the time of the invention was made. I'm greatly troubled with deciding or affirming the use of these declarations because it seems to me that we're opening the door to nefarious acts.
Well, Your Honor, there's no reason to believe these declarations were not reliable. They're from Dr. Kinney, who is a co-inventor.
They're not corroborated,
and,
correct?
Your Honor, they put in no counter-declaration. And what I wanted to say is that Dr.
No, answer my question. They're not corroborated. The Kinney declaration is partly written by the inventor, and our case law is clear on that. Where's the corroboration?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of a requirement for corroboration of a sworn statement.
Well, the answer is the corroboration is the data existed at the time, right?
And the data that
he
provided.
It's a business record argument.
We believe it's a business record. And also
but
the
did
data
you submit the entire data set or just part of it?
He submitted, as he said in his second declaration, he submitted all of the second generation data. That's the F2:3. And the thing I wanted to point out is the Kinney Declaration not only expressly discloses step A, it also goes beyond that and says that they made progeny plants from that cross, including not just the first generation, which is the F1. F1 is what's made by the initial cross-pollination between the two lines. F2 is a self-pollinated generation that is generated from the F1. And Dr. Kinney testified in his second declaration, he provided all of the data for the second generation, the F2:3. So what I wanted to point out is that the example 8 also expressly mentions the F2:3 generation that was obtained. So this is not a case where the second step is missing from Booth. It was expressly disclosed.
Did Monsanto argue below that there was a lack of corroboration?
They did not. And in fact, they put in no counter testimony. They had at least 7 months from the time of the second Kinney declaration, which was November 2012, until they filed their response to the action closing prosecution at the end of June 2013 to put in counter data, to put in counter declarations, scientific literature, anything. They put in nothing, Your Honor. And in fact, they argued at that time that there was good cause for claim amendments to amend their claims. They could have made the same argument under Rule 116E for good cause to submit additional declarations from Dr. Volker, from Dr. Harrison. They submitted nothing.
Well, the PTAB noted all that.
Exactly. And that's why the board found in this situation that there was no counter evidence to the proof of inherency. So we agree with the idea that data...
They also noted that there was no... They felt there was no dispute that his data accurately represented results.
That's right. And, Your Honor, if you look, for example, at the Glaxo case, where you had different different forms of a crystal. There was a dispute about that, whether the form would be always made by the patented method. And one side came in and showed, well, we always get it. Then the other side came in with counter data. That data didn't exist before.
Well, yes,
that was
evidence
that was generated for purposes of resolving the inherency dispute. No different here. It's simply evidence that was generated to show only one limited thing.
Okay, let me stop you.
Yes, Your Honor.
And ask you a question. You can use data to clarify a reference, but not to expand the disclosure of the reference.
But the F2:3 generation progeny is expressly disclosed.
Let me finish my question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't it the case here that the Kinney declarations are used to expand the disclosure?
No, they're used in exactly the way they're used in all of these cases when extrinsic evidence comes in. It's simply evidence that a court or the board will hear to help prove what otherwise is not expressly there. It's a high burden. You have to prove it would necessarily be true, which is exactly what the board found. But you can use extrinsic evidence to prove that fact, which is what happened here. And there was no counter testimony.
To prove inherency, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
There's no suggestion that the prior art reference expressly discloses the progeny.
No, that's incorrect.
But
they do.
The argument is that it's inherent.
This might have been a different case if it didn't show making.
Yes.
No, I don't agree. The reference expressly discloses the second generation.
Wait, don't talk over us, okay? The pre-existing prior art reference does not, on its face, disclose progeny within the scope of the claims, right?
No, it discloses the second generation progeny. The only thing it doesn't disclose is the fatty acid profile. I agree with that part, Your Honor.
Okay, so and you're saying that the production of progeny that come within the claims is inherent, right?
Well, the production of progeny was expressly disclosed, including the second generation.
No,
the only thing
qualifying
it wasn't
progeny.
Now, that's a very important point. The claim is extremely broad on step B. A single plant of any generation. It's what we argued in our brief. They didn't dispute that in their counter-briefing. So it couldn't be written any broader. It includes, you know, planting a seed and watering it and growing a plant of any generation.
I cannot understand why you're fighting this. I mean, it makes no sense. The prior art does not disclose qualifying progeny. You have to rely on inherency to get there, and you rely on the Kinney declarations to get you there, right?
We do rely on the Kinney declarations for the fatty acid profile. That's true, Your Honor. We do. But the point I was trying to make is that the claim is very broad. It doesn't just cover the first generation. It does cover the second generation, which is the first selfed generation of progeny. And the second generation is expressly mentioned in Example 8. So the only thing that the extrinsic data was used for the inherent properties of that expressly disclosed second generation. So that's really the only point I'm trying to make. And the claim is so broadly written, it covers any generation and a single plant.
So now that we arrived at the salient point of the problem that I have here with this case, and that's the use of extrinsic evidence like these declarations in order to establish inherency. I would think that you can't do it to establish anticipation, but inherency perhaps. But you haven't convinced me in your. I've convinced myself one way or the other, but you haven't convinced me. This is your time to do that.
Well, Your Honor, it's no different from Glaxo, for example. In Glaxo, as I said, you had two parties trying to show
so
whether
or not.
So can
you use a declaration to establish a missing limitation or to provide a limitation that's not in the prior art?
The prior art reference discloses expressly.
It's a yes or no question. Right.
We're using it only for that one limited purpose.
That's
of showing.
That's not a yes or no answer.
I'm sorry, could you repeat your question? I didn't understand the question.
Can you use a declaration, extrinsic evidence, in order to provide a limitation that's missing from the prior art in order to establish anticipation?
Yes, that's exactly the purpose of extrinsic evidence. Because the whole point of inherency is that you have a reference that is missing something that's not expressly disclosed.
Now, I thought you would argue you can't do it for anticipation, but you can do it for inherency.
Well, we're talking about inherent anticipation. It's really the same issue, Your Honor, I think. It's a theory of anticipation. Essentially, it's a theory in which the reference is missing some feature of the claim, and you rely on the extrinsic evidence to supply that feature. It's true it's a high burden, and it's a narrow doctrine. You have to show it would necessarily be true. We don't dispute that. But you can use extrinsic evidence, just like in Glaxo, just like in all the other cases we cited, to prove that missing feature would necessarily be present in what's described in the prior art. And that's exactly what happened here.
If it's necessarily present but wasn't, then we're talking about inherency.
If it wasn't present, there wouldn't be anticipation. We had to prove it would necessarily be present in the F2-3 generation, which is described in Example 8. We did that. We proved there were 45 plants that met Claim 1, 45. We only had to prove one, okay? So we proved 45. Again, Step B is so broadly written, it covers even one plant of any generation. They wrote the claim that way. They want it to be broad, but the problem is that sweeps in any generation of plant that meets the claim. I wanted to mention the claim construction issue. They only raised really one issue, and that is this tenths of a percent argument. And we did point out that was never raised before the board, so that argument was waived in our view. It's also quite indefinite. They never say how many tenths of a percent the claim would be limited to. And also, the board did rely on the intrinsic evidence here. It relied on the claim language, which is not limited to tenths. They relied on the specification that cites the Wilcox paper, which reasonably was supportive of a broader reading. And they also mentioned Dr. Kinney's testimony from the point of view of one of ordinary skill in the art. So we think that argument was waived, but also just contrary to the intrinsic evidence, Your Honors. Unless you have other questions.
Any further? No. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Hilbert.
I want to make something very clear about the procedural record in this case. DuPont's declarations were not arguing inherency. I would like to direct your attention to Appendix 360, paragraph 8.
You never objected to those declarations on the ground of lack of corroboration, right?
We argued that, I don't know if specifically lack of corroboration. We pointed out they didn't have anything to do with the legal standard.
You did not argue lack of corroboration.
I do not believe lack of corroboration specifically. There were many legal objections and many factual objections.
You know
objections.
Your record, don't you?
Yes, and I'm not aware of the
argument. No,
I am not aware. I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't believe so. But the point I'm trying to get across.
Did you object on the basis that the declarations were providing missing limitations?
Absolutely.
Or limitations missing from the reference?
Absolutely. We objected to the declarations as they're not even describing what they did. They're not claiming an inherent effect because they're not even making a claim of inherency. What they're doing, they're not saying that this is an inherent effect. What they did is missing information. They never made the claim, Your Honor.
Well,
they never argued
that
inherency.
They were there to show that the prior art used the same method and produced the same result that your claims do here, right?
They were not arguing inherency. They were arguing express anticipation through a calculation of a statistical deviation, Your Honor.
So your objection is they didn't use the word inherency?
My objection is they not only identified the nature of the argument they are now purporting to make, they didn't recite the legal standard. They made no effort to show it was inevitable. That is the legal standard they had to show in order for this to be relevant.
How can it be that they had to show it was inevitable when your own claims don't require that it be inevitable?
Our claims are to a different cross, Your Honor.
It doesn't matter. Don't interrupt me. Your claims do not require that the progeny be produced every time. It's sufficient. Do not interrupt me. They do not do that, right?
Correct.
Okay, so how can it be that inherent anticipation requires something the claims don't require?
Because it's a different legal standard. Inherency, in order for a prior art reference to inherently disclose something, it must inevitably disclose it. It must inevitably do it. They did not inevitably disclose. Booth doesn't inevitably disclose anything. The patentability is based on the prior art. And if the prior art doesn't expressly or inevitably disclose the claim language, then it doesn't anticipate.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hilbert.
Thank you, Your Honor.